All right. So first of all, I want to say thank you to Jeff for filling in and preaching last Sunday. Thank you. You'll have a chance for Jeff to come back again and again and again, but he'll be preaching again at the end of this month as I'll be heading up to Emory as I begin my final year in my doctoral work up there. So although I can honestly tell you, I've contemplated more than once saying, you know, who really needs, you know, that degree? But that's a different story. We had a good vacation. We went to NASA and got to, the cool part was we got to watch a rocket get launched, which was not on the schedule. Because of the rain, it had been canceled a couple times and kept getting pushed, and we happened to be there when it happened. But the really cool part was watching the same rocket that went up in space, that took the cargo up there and then released it, came back to the Earth to the same exact pad in which it lifted off from. That was pretty wild to watch. Imagine, you know, 50 years ago, you know, we sent people up to the moon, and then we didn't get all that stuff back. We got this little capsule that came back. So it's pretty wild what the mind is capable of doing. And as I share that with you, let me share with you our text for this morning. It comes from Paul's letter from Rome, beginning in the chapter 12. It says, "Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, in view of God's mercy, to offer your bodies as living sacrifices, holy and pleasing to God. This is your spiritual act of worship. Do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Then you will be able to test and approve what God's will is, His good, perfect, and pleasing will." This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. So let's talk about that for just a moment. This concept of do not conform to the patterns of this world. One way we might think about that is that if I came up here this morning and I was wearing outfits that dated back to the 1970s. You remember that time period? I'm in therapy because of the way my parents dressed me back then. You know, Joseph had his coat of many colors, but I had these pants of many colors. What in the world were you folks thinking back then? And flared out bell bottoms. I put Ronald McDonald on the map with some of the red shoes that I had to wear. But if I were to dress that way today, you would definitely say I am not conforming to the dress code patterns of the world, right? So when we talk about this idea, do not conform any longer to the pattern of this world. What are the current patterns of this world? For example, what does the world think about when we talk about money? Or what does the world think about when we talk about rest or play or dealing with our enemies? What does the world think about when we think about or we talk about vacation? My experience was that a lot of the world must have been thinking that Universal Studios was the right place to be because they all showed up when we were at Universal Studios. What does the world think about when it comes to getting older, or retirement, or dying? And if we're to no longer conform to this pattern of this world, we might want to know, how does the world think about these things? And then you might ask the question, well, who is the world when Paul's talking? What if Americans think one way and Europe or Africa think another? What pattern of the world am I supposed to be conforming to or not conforming to? What do I do if the patterns I have used all of my life have brought me security, stability, significance? They've helped me survive and even succeed in this world. Am I supposed to just walk away from those patterns? These verses that we're going to discuss this morning are some of my favorite verses in the Bible because they cause me to think. And my thinking, when I really create that space in my life and I allow myself to really think, they create more perplexing and troublesome thoughts. Do you know what I'm talking about? Now, some people might say, you know, you might just want to give up thinking then, if that's what happens in that process. But Paul says to me that that thinking, that process of thinking deeply about something, there's an author named Cal Newport that has written a book called Deep Work. And the idea is to be focused on something for a long period of time, on one thing, and thinking deeply into that. Paul would say this is a process of a spiritual act of worship. He tells me that by seeking a renewing of my mind, I might discover God's will, God's good and pleasing and perfect will. And so I like when I read that verse that says, be transformed by the renewing of your mind, because I think of it as a key to understanding the Bible. And more importantly, a key to remaining rooted in God. And that's what we've been talking about for the last several weeks, is this concept of how do we remain rooted in God. And that if our roots go deep, then we remain connected to the vine of God. And so I want to continue that conversation this morning. Now, as we talk about this concept of mind, we might remember that Moses said to the Hebrew people before they entered into the promised land, he gave them a pattern of thinking. He gave them a pattern in which to conduct their lives. It was known this way. You're to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your strength, with all your soul, right? And that was, he said that if you will follow that, if you will embrace that as part of your living, then you will inherit a land flowing with milk and honey. Almost 1,500 years later, Jesus would be confronted by an expert in the law and would be asked the question, what do you say is the greatest commandment? And Jesus said this, the greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul. And he added, and with all your mind. See, when I asked you earlier, you were ready to say, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your mind, with all your soul, with all your strength. But Jesus added that component. If you go back and look in Deuteronomy, and you look what Moses was talking about, if Jesus adds that component, he adds to Moses' pattern this concept of loving God with all your mind, because Jesus wants us to understand that our thinking was a fundamental component of being rooted in God. When I went to Emory and began my seminary work, one of the things that helped me move along in my process, in my growth, was an article written by John Wesley called Reason and Religion Joined. One of the reasons I remain a United Methodist is because we don't believe that you're to check your brain at the door. As United Methodists, we want you to be a thinking person, a critical thinking person. But my sermon is not going to be about how to critically think, but I'm asking us to think in that concept, especially as we think about the events of this past week and we think about the events within the last 24 hours in El Paso and in Dayton. And as you listen to the sermon this morning, I'm hoping that you will hear it in a way that will challenge the way you think about the least amongst us and about minorities. There are many things we think about, and Paul instructs us to discipline ourselves in a way that we capture every thought and we present them to God in such a way that they are transformed so that we can be more obedient to God in that process. And so this morning, even as I'm talking about thinking, it's like me saying to you, don't think about chocolate ice cream. Anybody thinking about chocolate ice cream? So if I tell you, don't think about thinking, what are you thinking about? Thinking. And so what I'm telling you is that we're instructed by Paul to take every thought captive. And so I'm going to say, you've got a bunch of thoughts right now that are coming at you. And this morning, I know that. But I want to take one thought in particular. I want to focus on this idea, how we think about the least and the greatest. And the reason I want us to think about that is because I'm talking about being rooted in God. And I think the ways in which we serve one another speaks volumes about how we stay rooted with God. I'm choosing that as our primary thought this morning because I want us to understand Jesus' words to his disciples after he washed their feet. He says, I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you. You will be blessed if you do them. I also want to argue that it is our thinking about the least and the greatest, the majority and the minority, whatever terms you want to use this morning, and that they're the same for me. They're synonymous this morning. When I use the least and the greatest, the majority and the minority, I'm using them in that way. But I want to suggest that it's our thinking about these that's creating this culture of fear we are experiencing in the U.S. And I want to argue that our thinking about how we relate to the least, the minority, is a major reason that Christianity is losing ground and effectiveness in America. Those are my premises, my arguments. I want to make this argument because how we think about the minority, the least, influences the way we feel and ultimately how we act towards them. If we don't think correctly, then we won't feel correctly. And if we don't feel correctly, we won't act correctly. Our thinking impacts the way we act. Another way of saying that, the result that I think all of us long for, that most Christians long for in their life, is to hear Jesus say, well done, good and faithful servant. But if we don't think and we don't act in a certain way, it's a good chance that we won't hear that. And while I believe that we are saved by grace, I also believe there will be a time in which we have to answer the question that God is going to say to me, Tim, how did you treat the least amongst you? How did you interact with the minority amongst you? At this point, I don't know what happens if I answer that question in a manner that suggests that I was actually more in alignment with the world than I was with God's will. All I can tell you is that at this moment, I can only hope that God would continue to demonstrate his grace and his mercy towards me. But I'm reminded of the story in the Bible of the rich man and Lazarus. And the rich man had missed caring for the minority in his midst. You know, Paul also foreshadows this possibility that when he spoke to the Gentiles, later on in this verse, he talks about this transition from being the minority to becoming the majority. That the Gentiles now were the beloved children of God. That didn't mean that God had turned away from the Jewish people. But they had now become the in crowd. And it was hoped that by their actions, by the way we lived our lives, it would cause the hearts of the Jewish people to change and be directed toward God. But Paul says to them, do not be arrogant, but be afraid. For if God did not spare the natural branches, the majority, he will not spare you either. Consider therefore the kindness and sternness of God. Sternness to those who fell, but kindness to you, provided that you continue in his kindness. I want to make this argument this morning because I want us to be deeply rooted in the heart and the mind of God. I want us to be in alignment with God. So let's take a moment to work out this definition of what we mean by minority. And all I want us to do is just to look at the gathered community that's here. And the reason I want us to look at the gathered community that's right here in this moment, at this time, is so that we develop the practice of walking into Walgreens or walking into the library or walking into Denny's or Cracker Barrel or whatever and scanning the room and figuring out who are the least amongst us. Who is the minority in that particular setting? It's too many of you, when you heard the words minority, or you heard the word least, let's say minority, you immediately went very general, very broad. You thought black, white, Hispanic, African. And I'm not talking in, that's part of that, but I want us to look right here. So for example, look at this room. Who are the minority in this room right now? Just shout them out. Okay, children. Okay, but we have children in this room, don't we? Right. Okay, because they have to be in this room for us to say. There are children out in the community, but okay, who else are minority in this room? Did someone say men? Men, yes. Yeah, so there are some women who are looking for dates. I'm getting in trouble on that comment, so. Just playing, okay? But yes, men, what else? Who are some other folks? Who? Hispanics, okay, thank you, right? So Hispanics, and what else? Anybody, how many people drive SUVs? Okay, not a lot of hands. So us SUV drivers, we're in the minority. All right, how many of you have a smartphone? Put your smartphone up, okay? We may be the majority. I was thinking we were going to be the minority in that. So what's my point? The majority, the minority is determined by the labels that we choose, correct? If I sat here and got really political, say, hey, how many of you are taller than 6 feet? Where's Andrew? He's not here today, right? Right? You would be in the minority, right? And the rest of us, you know, us 5 foot or 6 foot and below people would gang up on you tall people, right? That's the next question. If I wanted to create fear for the majority, what might I say to you about the minority? And again, we can think about the language that we use and what we say and how we go about doing that. But there's a biblical example that we can go and look at. When Pharaoh saw his majority slipping away, he created a sense of urgency and fear, saying, "Come, we must deal shrewdly with the Hebrew people, the minority, for they are growing too quickly for us. And if we're not careful," I'm going to throw in a year for you, because if you follow this, you may have already noticed this, but by the year 2045, the reason I'm sharing this with you as well as I'm part of my research is dealing with this idea of homogeneous congregations, you know, or white congregations. And I've read a book called White Christian America, The Death of White Christian America. And one of the things that it's talking about is that in the year 2045, for the first time, white people, white European people, white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, however you want to term that, will be in the minority. And so there's this, so what conversations do we use? What are we saying in that context? I know, again, I can feel some energy like, all right, where is he going with this? Trust me, I'm going to get us to the promised land, I think, right? But please stay with me on the ride, all right? So, but Pharaoh would say, if we're not careful, by 2045, we will be the minority and they will turn and fight us. They will destroy everything that is sacred to us. And so what does he do? He begins to create systems that would keep people in oppression. Now, these are biblical things I'm talking about. The problem is we have politicized these things, so we can't hear them with biblical ears. I'm asking you to hear them with biblical ears this morning. So let's think about this. What happens if I'm afraid, I'm in the majority, and I'm afraid that one day the minority is going to take over the world? Or whatever the case may be. If I'm Pharaoh, what am I doing? I'm going to operate out of fear. So what do I do with Jesus? What do I do with his teachings that he spent his entire life blessing the least around him? What do I do as a Christian who looks at Jesus and says, I want to emulate his life, I want to imitate his life, who taught his disciples how to live blessed, how to be a blessing, and how to remain a blessing, when he said, when I was hungry, you gave me food. When I was thirsty, you gave me drink. When I was without clothes, you clothed me. When I was sick, you visited me. And they asked, when did we do this? And what did Jesus say? When you did it to the least of these. When you did it to the minority. So again, I ask this, when you look around this community, and I'm saying right here, how are we treating? And again, it depends on how we label. I can label things. I could have said right off the bat, how many of you are Christians? right? How many of you are in church today? I now have a majority. I don't have to worry about the minority at all. So I can create labels that create certain things. But if I observe, just look around at people, right? I can discover who my minority is real quickly. Hi, Jack. Now, let me ask you this question. Do you know when I like those verses that says, when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was thirsty, you gave me water. You know when I like those verses? When I'm the minority. When someone pays attention to me. Just the thought. What happens to me, though, when I move from being the least to the greatest? What happens when I move from being in the minority position to now being in the majority position? In a week, Matthew will start high school. He gets to start out as a freshman. What happens when you move from being a freshman to being a senior? How do you relate to the freshman? Right? What was it like when you started out at the bottom in the job pool and now you climb to the top? How did you interact? What happens when you have been a Christian for 50 years and you're now working with someone who's just barely asking, what is Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John? That's the question I'm inviting you to think about. What happens when you move from being the least to being the one with the most? Let me put it in another example. So let's imagine that I was homeless and I had nothing. But 1 week, I managed to scrape together enough income for an entire week. I now had more than my homeless brothers and sisters. What do I do with that surplus? Do I share that surplus with them or do I protect it? There's a scene in the children's movie, a Disney movie of Aladdin. Aladdin steals a loaf of bread. And he sits down and he and Abu, his little side companion monkey, began to eat the bread. But they notice off to the right there are two small children who are also homeless. Abu and Aladdin give up their bread. They give the bread to the other children. I wish I were more like Aladdin. I wish in the example I gave that if I were a homeless person and this was suddenly to happen to me and I had this, I would be more likely to share. But I can tell you that I'm more likely to conform to the patterns of this world that tell me to protect what I have. To look out for myself, because if I share with somebody else, they may take advantage of me. I may only want to share half and they want to take 3/4 of what I'm offering. They want more. They may want more. And so I would tend to think about protecting. And let me tell you, because I am not more like Aladdin, I am part of the reason that Christianity has lost its effectiveness in the U.S. It is that reality and my desire to be more rooted in God. It's the reason I'm preaching this to you this morning that inspires me to challenge my thinking. Paul says at the beginning, when you go back and you look at that text, he says these words, in view of God's mercy. That needs to be our starting point. It needs to be my starting point. When I recognize just how little my thinking as it relates to this topic of care for the least, the minority, is in alignment with God. I have to come before the throne of God like the servant came before the master who had this great debt that he had no way of being able to pay back. And he goes to the master and he says, please have patience with me. And the master says, I will not only show you patience, but I will forgive your debt completely. I need to be like that servant coming before God yet again and saying, Lord, please have mercy, have patience with me. And then I have to be careful not to follow the same mistake that servant made. The mistake the servant made was to be moved from the minority to the majority, and he treated the minority with contempt. And he showed them no mercy or patience. He celebrated his new position. Earlier, I gave you the story of Pharaoh and his thinking as he realized that he was quickly moving into the minority. I want to ask you now this question. What do you think might have happened if someone had approached Pharaoh and challenged the way he was thinking to consider another option? Imagine if this person said, "Pharaoh, what do you think might happen if we start to share our blessings with the Hebrew people? Might they be more likely to embrace our way of life, our patterns of conduct in the world, and not become our enemies? What if we created this place where people just love to be with each other? Would they side with our enemies in that? What would happen?" My pie in the sky thoughts, my wishful thinking, my utopian kind of self would want to say, and they would live happily ever after. I think you might say that as well, that maybe if they did do that, those things would happen. But my Christianity tells me that people who tend to align their thinking with God's thinking, who tend to wash the feet of their betrayers, who feed their enemies, who bless those who persecute them, who touch the marginalized and ostracized, who fellowship with the outcast, who invite the least, the minority, to the great banquet, who welcome sinners as family. My Christianity tells me that these kinds of people tend to be crucified. So, as I continue in my spiritual act of worship this morning, challenging my thinking, desiring for my mind to be renewed, I find myself asking yet another question. Is the cause of Christ a cause worth dying for?
Yes.
We just talked about what happens. Is it a cause? Now, I'm not necessarily talking about physical death. I'm not inviting us to become martyrs, and I'm certainly not inviting you to drink the Kool-Aid after church in the Centennial Hall. It'll be fine, I promise. It's not, right? I'm not talking about that kind of death. But I am talking about what happens when you ask yourself the question, is the cause of Christ something I'm willing to die for? Am I really willing to go against the majority? If the majority is out of alignment with God's will. You think back to the 50s, what was happening? When you think back to the 60s, what was happening? When you think back to the 70s, what was happening? When you think back to the 80s, what was happening? When you think back to the 90s, what was happening? And you have to ask yourself the question, what side of the road was I on? How did I respond to those kind of things? What was the majority saying? And how did I go about discerning God's will? Am I willing to serve the least amongst us, even if it means I'm going against the majority? Am I willing to humble myself and become a servant so that others might live out God's dream for them? Paul challenges me in this text as well when he writes, "Honor one another above yourselves. Do not be proud, but be willing to associate with people of low position. Do not be conceited." Jesus spoke about this, and then through Paul, turns the American dream upside down. As an American, I dreamed that no matter what my situation in life was, no matter how I was brought up, no matter where I came from, that if I worked hard enough, tried hard enough, did enough work, I could taste the fruits of my labor. And I looked at people, and as I did that, I believed that the people who were on the top were the people who had worked the hardest, and the people that were below me were the people who worked the least. And I went through that life and I looked at that and I said, I admired and I emulated those who were ahead of me. And secretly inside of me, I built a resentment and conceitedness towards those who were below me. That was my thinking pattern. prior to being introduced to the cause of Christ. How has that cause challenged your thinking today? Are you still pursuing the American dream or God's dream? In a few moments, when you hear God's invitation to come to His table, will you hear the words, "Come just as you are"? You see, when God invites us to His table, He doesn't see majority or minority. He sees His beloved children. Whatever you do, know this: God is committed to having you fulfill the dreams He has for you. His dream is not to harm you, but to give you life, abundant life. But to experience the fulfillment of that dream, you have to be fully committed to the cause of Christ. And so as you prepare your heart and mind to come to the banquet table that's set for you, I invite you to hear again the words Jesus said to His disciples after He knelt down, after He took on the form of a servant, after He moved from the majority to the minority and washed the feet of His disciples. He says, "If you obey My commands, you will remain rooted in My love. This is My command: love each other as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that He lay down His life for His friends. I no longer call you servants, because a servant does not know the master's business. Instead, I have called you friends, for everything that I learned from My Father, I have made known to you." May we each choose today to go and live as friends of God. Will you pray with me?